So yeah, wonderful organizers for letting me the opportunity to speak here. Stephen was saying I will talk about flux tube integrability and the S matrix of n equal to 4. You can see it as a natural continuation of the two talks that we started with. This is talk work with collaboration with Fernando Aldai, Davide Gaiotto, Juan Maldacena, Tian Hang, and Pedro Vieira were here. So we heard in the two talks in the morning that we have this wonderful duality between scattering amplitudes of n gluons, say K1, K2, K3, and so on, and the expectation value of a Wilson loop, which has a polygon shape. Whose edges are related to the momenta of the gluons, as follows, it's deadly K1, K2, K3, and so on. And the duality said that planar scattering amplitudes in n equal to 4 supernumeraries are equal to the expectation value of these polygon Wilson loops in the same theory. And as Simon and Dave explained us, right now we understand how this duality works for the MHV case, as well as for all the other possible helicity, which is our the next two MHV cases. Now, both, by now we know how to compute these amplitudes or Wilson loops at weak coupling to few orders in perturbation theory. We also know how to compute these Wilson loops to leading order at strong coupling. And what is needed to be able to compute these observables at any value of the coupling is the missing ingredients is to map the problem to a 1+1 dimensional problem and then to use integrability. This is at least the way that the spectrum in n equal to 4 was solved. And this is what I'm going to discuss today. This is what we call the operator product expansion for scattering amplitudes or Wilson loops. After doing this expansion, we will identify two lines, arbitrary two lines of this polygon Wilson loop. We will think about them as the trajectories of some quark and an antiquark moving at the speed of light and sourcing a flux tube between them, like that. We will then think about the expectation value of the Wilson loop as some transition amplitude on this flux tube. That is, we will take a limit, this is called a multicollinear limit. This is a limit where, let's say, all the cusps here or the bottom approach this line and become collinear. In this limit, we will think about the expectation value of this Wilson loop as some transition amplitude on this color flux extended between the quark and the antiquark. All what we, I'm going to describe this expansion in some details, but I want to emphasize that all we really rely on in this expansion is the fact that we have the theory is conformal and that we have such a stable flux. Color flux. It's therefore do not rely to some value of the coupling, weak or strong coupling, and what gives us the bridge between the weak coupling computation and strong coupling computation. In, after me, Benjamin here will talk about the dynamics of exactly this flux, and we'll see that we now understand it to a certain extent any value of the coupling. And we will use this data to compute these observables, ideally at any value of the coupling. So before going into the details, said that this expansion is based on conformal invariance. However, the expectation value of such Wilson loops suffer from UV divergences. This comes from these gluons that exchange near the cusp. or in the dual picture, this cutting amplitude is suffered from IR divergences that come from soft gluon exchange between the external adjacent gluons. However, these divergences, by now we well understand and we know how to sum them at any value of the cutting. Once we understand this divergence, we can subtract it and obtain a finite quantity that is conformally invariant. That is, we will regularize this observable and in that way obtain some finite function that is only function of the conformally invariant data. For example, in the MHV case, it will be only function of the conformal cost ratios made up of the cusps of the polygon. Let this point be x1, this point be x2, x3, and so on. And this would be the the conformal cost ratios made of the cusp of the polygons. In this multicollinear limit, these conformal cost ratios take the following form, say chi I j k l equal to x I j square x k l square over x I k square x j l square. Some of them that involve these densities here, distances here, that goes to zero, will approach zero in this multicollinear limit. So let me define this to be e to the minus tau, and this would go to zero in this multicollinear limit. So another way of thinking about this expansion is the approach to the multicollinear limit of this amplitude or polygon Wilson loop. For MHV case, this finite function f that we defined is the following. We find what is called the reminder function, r, which can be defined by the log of the expectation value of this Wilson loop, which by itself suffers from these UV divergences, minus some known function of the coupling, which calls the cusp anomalous dimension, time log of the same Wilson loop, but evaluated in a U1 theory. In a U1 theory, all you have to do is to exponentiate the gluon propagator. And this piece is also known as the BDS ansatz. For non-MHV amplitude and to K-MHV, what we heard in the previous talk, we define what is known as the ratio function. The amplitude for this N2K MHV case is defined to be the amplitude, let's say, and gluon for the MHV case times the ratio function. Okay. I'll define it in that way. Remove even that. This is the generating function. It's valid for any helicity of the gluons, and this was the subject of the talk of Simon and Dave before. This function here is, again, finite function that is conformally invariant. Wonderful thing about this duality is that what is three-level amplitude on this side map into higher loop amplitude in the Wilson loop side. Or to be more precise, the number of loops in the Wilson loop picture, you can switch to slides, please. Excuse me? Switch to slides. So here we see, for example, the number of loops in this y direction, and here the next to MHV level. So for example, for MHV amplitude, at three level, there is nothing to compute, just one. At one loop, we can have one gluon exchange. At two loops, we can have two gluons exchange, and so on. Whereas at next to MHV level, already at three level, from the Wilson loop picture, we have one exchange. Here, for example, a scalar between this edge and this edge. And as we go into higher loop, it is dressed by more and more gluons. And for next to square MHV case, we have here, for example, two scalar exchange, and so on. So note that the number of loops from the Wilson loop picture is not the number of loops from the amplitude, but the number of loops plus the next to MHV level. This means that we are in a perfect situation. We have, therefore, infinite amount of data here from the Wilson loop picture at any loop order, because we know, using BCFW recursion relation, for example, all three-level amplitude for any possible helicities. Once we analyze, and this is what I'm going to describe today, this data from this flux loop point of view, you have to understand the structure to any loop order. Before going and use this expansion to practically compute these observables, let me start by just explain what exactly is this expansion. So I'll start by doing an analogy with the more familiar case, which is the correlation function of local operator in a conformal field theory. So consider, for example, the four-point function of four local operators in a conformal field theory. The way we bootstrap, the way we use conformal invariance to compute this four-point function is the following. We first choose 2 points for the expansion, for example, which you can choose here to be 0 and here infinity. And we divide the 4 points into 2 groups. One group here, which I'll call bottom. This is this group here. And the other group here, which I'll call top. This is the group here. We'll then act with those generators of the conformal group that leaves these 2 points, 0 and infinity, invariant, only on the bottom group of points, making them approach into 0. In this limit where they approach 0, we expand this correlation function in terms of the full spectrum of the theory of states propagating from the bottom to the top. And these states are characterized by the quantum numbers of these generators of the conformal group that leaves these 2 points invariant. This would be the dimension, which is the eigenvalue of the dilatation operator, and in general, the spin, which is the eigenvalue of rotations around 0 in that example. So, more explicitly, we have this O1, let's say, of X, O2, a 0, O3, at 1, and O4 at infinity. And we write this as a sum over all the possible excitation in the theory, all the possible states parameterized by their quantum number, some coefficient, let me call it C of delta and L, and the propagation from the bottom to the top, which in this case will be 1 over X to the power 2 delta. And suppose we are in 2 dimensions, there will be also a spin, X over X bar to the power L. Since we have a conformal symmetry, there is a nice way of compacting together the propagation here from the bottom to the top of the conformal primaries and all the conformal descendants. And this is the more familiar way of writing this four-point function, where we sum only of primary excitations times the three-point structure constant, C1 to P, CP, 3, 4, times what we call the conformal block of 1, 2, 3, 4, and X. What is conformal block? It's just this part in the sum of a given conformal primary and all its conformal descendants. What we will do now from this picture for the polygon Wilson loop is exactly the same. Let's consider a pair of a quark here and an antiquark moving at the speed of light in some direction. And as we described before, they will create some flux tube in between them. Now, two such null lines preserve first an SL2 symmetry, which is SL2 symmetries of these two null lines. So they will preserve an SL2 R symmetry. In addition, they preserve another generator of the conformal symmetry, which just translates points here between the line, between the two null lines on the plane where they, when I draw them. So I'll call this direction R sigma. And there is another another symmetry of these two null lines, which is just rotation in the transverse plane. So these two null lines, in addition, preserve an SO2 generator of the conformal group. The analog of this symmetry of the two null lines is the conformal symmetry that we started here for the correlation function of local operators. What we then do, we fix a conformal frame, same as choosing here, these two points, 0 and infinity. We choose here, say, two points on this null line, and then draw the null lines that cross the other. Okay? Once we choose this conformal frame, these two points, this symmetry of the two null line is broken to a subgroup, the subgroup that preserves our conformal frame. In that case, the subgroup that preserves the point 0 infinity, in that case, the subgroup that preserves also these two null lines. So this breaks this SL2R into a single generator that I'll call R tau, and now the full symmetry of this, what we'll call the reference square, is R tau times R sigma times an SO2 in the transverse direction that we will denote by phi. Now, suppose we have here the bottom of the Wilson loop and here the top. We divide these edges. We call them the bottom edges. Well, these ones we will call the top. And we now act only on the bottom part of the Wilson loop with these generators of the conformal group that leaves our reference square invariant. In particular, when we act on them with, with this generator, R tau, that translates points along these null lines, all these cusps on the bottom will approach the bottom of the reference square. And in this limit, we will think about all these pictures as a transition amplitude of the flux tube. Some excitations are created on the bottom, propagating on the flux, and being absorbed on the top. Let's see now how we make this picture for practical. How we can use it to practically compute the amplitude. So, what form we expect for this transition amplitude? We expect it to take the. Can we turn on the slides, please? We can expect it to take the following form. We expect it. I'll use it. We expect the expectation value, therefore, of this Wilson loop in this limit to be given by the following, a sum over all the possible of the charge under this SO2 rotation and under this translation in sigma, call it M, into the I M phi. Integral dp into the minus ip sigma. This are just the two charges conjugated into translation in these two directions. And then some form factors, but let's see, okay. Sum over all the our excitations. In the theory, a form factor for creating this excitation in the bottom, a propagation piece, and an absorption in the top will be a form factor, C delta. Of P, the propagation, which, as I did here, we will gather them into a conformal block, which will be the sum over the conformal primary, in this case, SL2 conformal primary, because this is the symmetry of the two null lines, and all its conformal descendants, call it F delta and N, and P of tau. So this, for example, will describe the propagation of a single excitation from the bottom to the top. In addition, we can have now two particle excitations and so on. Note that this is a difference between our case here with the Wilson loop and the case with correlation function of local operators. The reason is that this direction that move points in this direction, this sigma, is non-compact. So we have a non-compact direction with the gap excitations. This means that we can really characterize the states that propagate from the bottom to the top by one particle, two particles, and so on. So let me now consider the simplest case. The simplest case that I would consider today is the fixed gluon amplitude at next to MHV level. So first, why six gluons? Which one I'll use? Let me use here. Today we'll compute the amplitude for six gluon at next to MHV level using this operator product expansion picture. And the reason for choosing six gluon is twofold. One, we have a conformal cross ratios. 6 point is the first time that there are non-trivial conformal cross ratios, so there is a function to compute. And second is the first case that we have a next to MHV amplitude, because for six gluon case is the first case that we have an next to MHV amplitude that is not MHV bar. If you will consider five gluon amplitude, it will be the same as the MHV bar, and we have nothing to compute. What we will do is we will first use, for example, BCF W to get the value of this A6 at 3 level. And next, we will use this OPE picture, operator product expansion picture, to do two things. One thing, we will compute all the six gluon amplitude at one loop, just starting from the 3 level. So all A6 at one loop. And the second thing we will do, we'll give all the predictions to a piece of the amplitude. So some all loop prediction. Before carrying on this program of starting from 3 level and then computing it at one loop using this OPE picture, I would like to introduce the most natural variables to do this calculation, which are momentum twisters. These are the same twister that Dave and Simon were talking about in the previous talk, but I'd like to present them in a slightly different way. So the reason we use these variables is first they trivialize all the constraints. They trivialize the fact that the polygon is null, and they trivialize momentum conservation. And the second is that conformal invariants act linearly on these variables. So let me explain how we define them. First, we can think about flat space, about R11 flat space, as the light cone in R2,4. This is all the points y in R2,4 that square to zero. The way to embed, to map R11 into the light cone of R2,4 is if we define this y plus and minus to be some two light cone direction in R2,4, we can factor out the plus direction, and then we will remain with 1 x squared and then the 4 vector x of R1,3. So this is the map between the light cone of R2,4 and flat R1,3. By choosing a different slice, one can embed any space that is conformally equivalent to flat space. One nice thing is that the conformal transformation that acts on the regular R1,3 are just Lorentz transformation of R2,4. In particular, they act linearly. The way we now define the momentum twisters is the following. Remember that now this y's are null, are null vectors, and therefore we can use the six-dimensional gamma matrices to write them as a product of two twistors. This index A now runs from 1 to 4. I will donate this product of two twistors by z wedge z tilde. This z are the momentum twistors. And the nice thing is that now conformal transformation just act as an SL2 transformation of this z. They act linearly. How can we now use this momentum twister to parameterize the polygon? This is the following. Suppose we have some null polygon. We assign to each edge of the polygon a momentum twister. Now, if we have two points in in the light cone of R2, 4, the distance between them is proportional to the distance between the two points in R1, 3. We now donate the cusp location of this polygon by just zi, wedge zi plus 1. And so we see that first, automatically, we have now a closed null polygon, but the reason that is null is the following. If we now compute the distance between two adjacent cusps, on the one hand, it's proportional to the distance between these two cusps in R1, 3. On the other hand, it's equal to the contraction of the corresponding four twisters, two of that point and the other two of that point. However, both of them, in that case, share ZI. What this wedge mean is a contraction of these four twisters with an epsilon tensor. And since two twisters are the same, this is just equal to zero. So we see that in that way, all we have to do is to choose a set of n momentum twisters, and we automatically have a null closed polygon. Okay. So this, I will also donate this contraction of four momentum twisters with the angle bracket. Let's now see with the simplest case how we parameterize our reference square using these momentum twisters. All we have to do is to choose four momentum twisters, one for the top, one for the bottom, one from the right, and one from the left. Now, any such four momentum twisters, we can always use conformal transformation to bring them to be the trivial four vectors, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, and 0, 0, 1, 0. Okay? Now, remember that before I stated that the symmetry of the reference square is just R tau times R sigma times SO2 for the transverse direction. Let's see how these symmetries become trivial once we use momentum twisters. Which SL4 transformation would preserve these vectors of zeros and one? This is trivial, any diagonal matrix. Here we see that on the top two, we have e to the sigma and e to the minus sigma, and on the bottom two, we have e to the tau and e to the minus tau. This just translates points along the right and left edges and along the bottom edges. For example, to see that, note that any point, for example, on the left edge would be a linear combination of z left with z bottom plus z left with z top. And what's this 2e to the sigma here does is rescaling z left and z right in a different direction, in opposite rescaling. And therefore, they shift the linear combination of these two points and move the points along the left edge. In the same way, this e to the tau, I think here what I meant is on the bottom edge, if I meant the sigma, and e to the tau, which is the one that do opposite rescaling of the top and the bottom, is the one that translates here. Okay? If we did not close it into a reference square, but just was talking about these two null lines, then the first block here would be just the SL2 symmetry of these two null lines on the bottom and on the top, where the 2x2 block down here would be the SL2 symmetry of the right and left null lines. Using the same logic that I did here, this SL2, for example, you can see that it just translates point along the left and right edges, but as opposed to just the generator dictated by tau, it do not preserve the two cusps here of the reference square. Again? Oh, this is determinant one. What I'm saying is that any matrix here with determinant one would translate points along this null line. Let's now use this this momentum twisters and symmetries to describe our hexagon. Okay? So here I draw an hexagon. We have a six edges. And we parameterize them by Z1 up to Z6. And the dotted line here is the reference square. And to parameterize now this hexagon, all we have to do is to choose some arbitrary six momentum twisters. We automatically have a null hexagon. What we'll do, we'll divide them into top and bottom, and then act with those symmetries of the reference square on the bottom part. In that way, we will generate a three-parameter family of hexagons. So here, suppose we started from some arbitrary set of six momentum twisters, such as they share these two null lines with the reference square. We then act with this matrix M, diagonal matrix M that we saw before, only on the bottom twisters, on Z2 and Z3 in that case. And when we act on them, we generate this three-parameter family of hexagon. Okay? Now, the hexagon has three independent cross ratios. For example, U2 is given by these two distances between X1 and X3, between X4 and X6, divided by these two distances. And the other two independent cross ratios are just cyclic rotation of this one. Using momentum twisters, they can be written in that form. For example, X13 would be Z1, Z2, Z3, Z4, the distance between X1 and X3 square. If we plug in into this four bracket of momentum twisters, this is just a determinant of four of the lines here. If you plug them in, we get just 1/cosτ. So you see that in particular, in the limit where tau goes to infinity, this cost ratio goes to zero. Why? Because these two points become null separated, and this point here on the bottom approach the bottom of the reference square. What we'll do now is expansion of the hexagon in this limit. Okay? So let me start by remind you what is the three-level value for this hexagon, for the six Luon amplitude at next to MHV level. So the way we write it is the following. We write the generating function of all next to MHV three-level amplitude with six external gluons. And it can be written using what we call these etas. These are just bookkeeping parameters for all the possible ellipticities of the of the amplitude. And the specific ellipticity I will focus on today, what I'll call R2356, is the one, it's the coefficient of eta 2, eta 3, eta 5, eta 6 in this expansion. It means that the gluons 2, 3, 5, and 6 carry some ellipticity above MHV. We can now, the way we compute it is, one way is using VCFW, and this generating function can be written as a sum of these five products that Dave described. This would not be crucial for us. These five brackets can be written in that way using the four momentum twisters and the corresponding bookkeeping parameters, the etas. What will be important to us is that once we do this expansion and read the coefficient of eta 2, eta 3, eta 5, eta 6, it's just given by this simple result. 1 over the 4 bucket of 2, 3, 5, 6. And if we plug in the our momentum twisters, we find that this is nothing but just the function 1 over 4 cos tau cos sigma plus cos phi. What we would like to do next is to rewrite this three-level result as a sum of propagation of particles from the bottom to the top. So let me write it here. Here is the hexagon, and this is X2, and this is X5, this is H2, 3, 5, 6, and this specific component can be computed from the super loop described by Simon and Dave as the propagation of a scalar between these two edges. So, in particular, can be written as follows. Here, I see this. This R, 2, 3, 5, 6, that can be written as 1 over X2 minus X5. This is just the scalar propagator between these two cusps. Then it gets dressed by what is called 2, 3. This is the contraction of two elicity spinors associated with momentum 2 and 3, and the same with 5 and 6. And this is the same as this 1 over 2, 3, 5, 6 that we got above. But we see from this picture that we expect some scalar propagate from the bottom to the top. Let me now describe just a set of facts about this three-level amplitude and its one-loop generalization, and then we will go slowly and derive them. So the first thing is that this R, this three-level result written here, or given there by 1 over cos tau cos sigma plus cos phi, can be written as a sum over all possible charges e to the m phi, all possible momentum integral p sigma, a form factor for creating this excitation on the bottom and absorbing it on the top, and a conformal block that gather together this the primary excitation and all its conformal descendants. And what are these functions? The form factor. So what I meant E here is just 1 plus the absolute value of M. The form factors we will find is just given by a beta. This is gamma gamma over gamma of E plus IP over 2 and E minus IP over 2. And very similarly, the conformal blocks are just hypergeometric functions, again with the coefficient E plus IP over 2, E minus IP over 2, E and 1 over cos tau. The way to think about this conformal block, this is just is large tau, we just go 1 over E times tau, the propagation of the primary from the bottom to the top, plus all its conformal descendants. Now suppose we want to go to one loop. At one loop, this R, 1, 2, 1, 3, 5, 6, we can divide it into several pieces. At one loop, there will be a piece that is linear in tau and piece that is not linear in tau. In other words, the one loop amplitude, a discontinuity, the one loop ratio function is a discontinuity between tau equal to 0 and tau equal to infinity. And the coefficient of this discontinuity is what we will call B0. B0 is given by the same expansion. All we have to do is to dress it by gamma of E over 2, where gamma is given by this function. Just a combination of psi function. In a minute, I'll go and rederive all of this result in details. I just want to give you some preview to what we are going to do now. Similarly, at any higher loop order, there will be a piece in the ratio function that go like tau to the L at a loop. And again, this piece will just be given by the same psi, the same sum, just now dressed by gamma to the power L. Let me now use the slides to explain how do we derive these results. So here is the way we express here. This sum is the sum of a form factor, 4-bit primary excitation, and the conformal blocks. And this is the values of C and F that we find. So maybe before, so as I explained here, what we expect to happen, we expect to see a scalar inflowing from the bottom to the top. How do we check if that is indeed the case? Even if we didn't knew that, what we do, we take this flux tube and we cut it at some point in the middle. Then we measure all the charges of the particles that's flowing from the bottom to the top. What we measure is what I'll call the SL2 Casimir of the state here, the propagate from the top to the bottom. How we do that? So let me first anticipate the charges of these excitations, but we will just find them without, we don't need to anticipate them before. Since this is scalar, the scalar excitation that we expect to find here correspond to dz to the m times some scalar of n equal to 4, where this z is just a complex complex coordinate parameterized the transfer direction. So in particular, this dz to the m carry charge m under this phi. And similarly, we have dz bar power minus m acting on phi. These are the primary excitation that we expect to find. But let's really find them now. So the SL2 Casimir for a general excitation here, dc, is given by the energy of this excitation times the energy minus 2. And what we call the energy is actually the twist of this excitation. If we now want to act with this Casimir on the ratio function, all we have to do is the following. This is given by J1 squared minus J2 squared plus J3 squared. Again, acting on the ratio function, where these J1, J2, and J3 are the free generators of SL2R. What we have to do is to act with them on the bottom twistors of the hexagon. So this is just given by a sum, A equal to 1 up to 3, minus 1 to the A, these free generators of D to the theta square, this R, where we leave the twister of the top, the left, and the right invariant, and act with this generator, e to the theta ja, on the twister of the bottom. These are 2 and 3 in our parametrization. So this is the way the Casimir act on this amplitude, on this ratio function. Note that for this excitation, this energy E is given by 1 plus or minus M. This E, I remind you, is the dimension minus the spin. This excitation don't carry any spin, so this is just the dimension of naive dimension of this operator. 1 for the scalar plus M for all the derivatives. We can now compute, we can now just act with this Casimir on the ratio function for this 3, 2, 5, 6, and subtract what we expect from the Casimir. That is, we can now act with C, and in that form, minus d phi square minus 1. D phi will bring us an m, so d phi square minus 1 is just what we expect for the Casimir if we plug this energy inside here. So we act with this operator on this r, 2, 3, 5, 6, and indeed what we find is 0. This means that such a decomposition exists. This is really spectacular. This is just a second order differential operator that we just cook, given based on this picture, and we find that indeed it annihilates. The amplitude that was computed before just by three-level BCFW relation, for example. How do we find now this decomposition once we know it exists? We do the following. So here I wrote again this operator acting on R 2, 3, 5, 6, and we find that it's indeed zero. Next, we have to find what are the conformal blocks. The conformal blocks are just solving the same equation, but with a general energy E. We just solve this second order differential equation, and the solution is what we call the conformal blocks. These are iter geometric functions that start at 1 over E to the E times tau, just the propagation of the primary, plus its all conformal descendants. Next, after we found this conformal block, we want to decompose this R 2, 3, 5, 6 in these conformal blocks. Note that this conformal block here depends on the choice of which amplitude we are looking at. It depends on the helicity of these 2, 3, 5, 6. The reason is that this amplitude, you can think about it as the analog of a correlation function of operators that are carrying spin. And therefore, the conformal blocks depends on the spin of the operator. In that case, it depends on the helicity of the gluons of the amplitude we are looking at. All we have to do now is to write it as a sum over all possible charges. This is just a discrete Fourier transform, or possible n times phi, Fourier transform the sigma direction, and read the leading coefficient of e to the minus tau. The coefficient of this leading term in the expansion at large tau is the conformal block, is the form factor, sorry. And all this expansion should automatically be the conformal block. So previously in Mathematica, we expand this 1 over cos phi, cos tau, plus cos sigma, and we read what are these form factors. What we find is that, they are these beta functions, gamma, gamma over gamma. The way to think about it, this is almost the same as just a rational function of p divided by sinh p. So if we close this path integral in the upper or lower half planes, depends on the value of sigma, we will pick poles at the zeros of sinh of p. And these poles just correspond to the charge conjugate to sigma of these excitations, which is also called the conformal spin. This is the result that we obtained for this specific coefficient, 2, 3, 5, 6. However, the sixth gluon amplitude at next to MHV level have many other possible choice of helicities. And once written in terms of momentum twisters or any other known variables, they look completely different. However, once we write them as these sums of form factors, time, conformal blocks, they all look almost identical. The only difference between them is for the sum of them, we find some small shift here, for example, in the conformal block, and here in the form factor. This is, for example, the biggest shift that we ever find. Usually we find only one of these two. So again, many different helicities that a priori look very different look almost identical once written in terms of this sum. Suppose now we want to go from three level to one loop. We started from the three level and we understood it as some set of excitations propagating in this flux tube from the bottom to the top. Now we don't want to use this information to bootstrap to compute the one loop ratio function. Once we go from three level to one loop, this amplitude, this exchange of a scalar here, can have three types of loop corrections. One is it can exchange of a gluon with one of these two null lines. This indicates a correction. This indicates a correction to the energy of this excitation due to its interaction with the flux tube. Other thing we can have a correct, we can have, for example, now two particle exchange. We can have a gluon exchange from the bottom to the top in addition to the scalar. And last, we can have correction to the form factor for the probability to create this excitation on the bottom and absorb it on the top. From all these three types of correction, this correction coming from interaction with the flux tube has a unique a unique contribution to the one-up result. And the reason that it's in the exponent, you get e to the minus e zero plus g squared gamma times tau. And once we expand in g, we bring tau from the exponent down to the down. And therefore, we obtain a term that is linear in tau. So let me, since I'm running out of time, let me switch gear a bit. So here is the one-loop result. It has this term linear in tau coming from the correction to the energy plus all the rest. And this term linear in tau is given again by the same expansion. Now, the rest by this correction to the energy, by this gamma. And this gamma we can now read from integrability what is the correction to the energy of this excitation. And this is what I believe Benjamin will talk right after me. It's given by this combination of psi functions. So when we do so, we find, for example, that this term linear in tau for the coefficient 2, 3, 5, 6 is given by the three-level result times log of u1, u3 over 1 minus u2. We now want to get not just the term linear in tau, but also the full amplitude. However, now we don't have cyclicity because different edges carry different ellicity. So we don't have cyclicity. Instead, what we use is supersymmetric world identities. And roughly, and just to illustrate the way that the world identity works is the following. Here is a different coefficient of this ratio function, the one that has eta 1, eta 1, eta 4, eta 4, is described by a scalar exchange between these two edges, edge 1 and edge 4, and it doesn't seem to have any good OP interpretation in this channel of things flowing from the bottom to the top. However, still, it has the same discontinuity. It has still such a term, linear in tau. The reason is the follow, we can use this supersymmetric world identity to express it as a sum of five other components, all have good OP interpretation in this channel, all have something flowing from the bottom to the top. And here, all we actually need is only two of them. The other three are related to this one just by symmetries, sigma to minus sigma, and phi to minus phi. So once we compute these two, we can obtain the discontinuity, the term linear in tau, of all other components in this direction, in this channel, 1-4. And then similarly, using cyclicity, we can obtain the discontinuity in all other channels. Other channels correspond to different choices of two null edges. Once we computed the term linear in tau, or the discontinuity in what we call U2, and the discontinuity in the other two cost ratios, U1 and U3, we want now to obtain the full result. So here is, for example, the what we found for these two discontinuity, and we want now to find a function that once you take a discontinuity, you obtain this result. I would, let me not go into details, this is, since it's just a transcendental two function, this is very easy, and this is the result we find. Let me just summarize the logic of what we did here. From VCFW, for example, we can obtain all three level amplitudes for any possible ellicity. Once we map them to the super loop picture, in there they are given not by three level amplitudes, but by L plus K loop amplitude, where K is the next to MHV level. Therefore, we have infinitely amount of data from this Wilson loop picture. Note that all we really care for this Wilson loop picture is that we have this flux to picture and some excitation propagating on top of this flux from the bottom to the top. We did not need a priori, for example, for this example, to know that what we have is a scalar propagating from the top to the bottom. We can just act with the Casimir and measure what is flowing. We did not need even to know that it was obtained by some Wilson loop computation. It can equivalently be obtained by a correlation function, or in that case, by BCFW from the amplitude. The computation did not rely on any Feynman diagram or four-dimensional computation. We just did map the problem to a problem in 1+1 dimension and then use the data from integrability from spin chain, which was this anomalous dimension, to compute the discontinuities in this channel. And that way, we obtain the full one-loop result. And in addition, obtain predictions at any loop orders. These are this D zero at any loop order. Note that even the anomalous dimension from integrability we did not really need. We could consider one example where the one loop result is known, read it from there, and then use it for all the other. So this is really a powerful techniques, and we're now in the ideal situation that we understand the dynamics of this spin chain at any loop order, and we have infinite amount of data at any loop. All we have to do is to analyze it from this picture, and then hopefully understand the all loop structure. So for example, what we are doing now, at next parametry, we have two particles. And what we expect in integrability is once we understand the dynamics of two particles, we understand the dynamics of any number of particles because their interaction factorized into two particles interactions. So here's just a picture. Currently, this is the coupling lambda, and this is the number of particles. We know number of particles from this spin chain point of view. We know the result at few orders in perturbation theory. We know the result at strong coupling. And this OPE, using integrability of the spin chain, we hope to give us the bridge in between them. Thank you.
Questions?
Hi. Yeah. Do you have any idea about how to compute correction to these form factors from first principle? Or,
So the direct answer is no. Currently, the way we do is we compute them in, say, one channel and then demand channel duality. That you would obtain a consistent answer in all possible channel. And this seems to at least at two loops in MHV case or at one loop at next to MHV to fix them uniquely. We didn't need to compute them from first principle. You see that what they indicate in a sense is all, for example, the conformal spins of the excitation is the poles in the form factors. But no, we don't know how to compute them from first principle.
But is it possible to isolate or to give some operator definition of it? Because when we look at the expressions that you derive by, I would say, inverse Fourier transform of known results to read these form factors. At the end, the expression looks pretty similar to some quantity we saw yesterday during the talk by Jan Balitsky, for instance, where they have also some kind of form factors or something like this. And I don't know if one can isolate the piece you need, derive an operator expression, and maybe make independent computation of this quantity.
In principle, if let this be the bottom of the square, it should be something like inserting this operator, for example, this scalar derivative in our case, along this bottom edge, and integrate it with some measure. But we haven't successfully done so. It's not clear what is the measure to integrate it along the edge. Okay.
Okay, since we are running out of time, maybe we can let's thank to Sever once more. And, before the next